This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 283 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
We had the opportunity to interview Outlander songstress Rhea Yarbrough. We hope you enjoy the interview. So welcome, Rhea Yarbrough, here to the Outlander podcast. So thrilled to have you. It is maybe not for you, which I completely understand, but for us, it's like it's about time. Because we're so happy to have you.
Oh, this is my pleasure. I love doing anything Outlander. It's always fun. It's always a good vibe.
Let's get right into it. Before we get into your new album, mm-hmm. North of Sunset, West of Vine, Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood? What was the musical? What was this fertile ground, if you will? What was your childhood like?
Well, I come from two artists, so I was doomed to be an artist. There's no other way around that. My dad is Martin Yarbrough is a singer-songwriter, and my mom, Pam Douglas, is she's known for being a screenwriter, but she's a fine artist. She was an artist when she was in her 20s, and she kind of took a long break and wrote screenplays for my whole life. And now she's back to being a painter, sculptor person. So I started off life like that. And then after that, I just, recognized that was something I wanted to do, and kind of great. I think the biggest jumping off point in terms of like inspiration and direction came from kind of the tragedy of my family splitting apart, which is that my parents, they got divorced when I was 7, and my dad went back to living, on Hollywood Boulevard in kind of a shitey studio apartment. And back to his job of, singing in nightclubs. And, the way it worked out, I stayed with my dad on weekends. And that's when you work, as a musician, weekends are the work ends. That I made up a new word, but that's what they are for musicians, work ends. And and so he took me with him, and I began singing in clubs when I was 7. And it was not glamorous, because these were bars, these were places where definitely I was, more than a decade below the age limit, but I learned to sing on stage, and I really, really increased my repertoire. The first song I learned was called Stormy Weather, which Lena Horne made famous. And that was kind of it. It was like a real joy and a real power and a real sense of self that I got. It was necessary and therapeutic after, your childhood bubble kind of gets busted by recognizing that your parents are people, and people, sometimes have needs that don't complete the whole family unit fantasy, luckily my parents were friends, and they care deeply for each other still today. We're all still very close, but it was sort of like a mini adulthood happened there. And learning to express myself in that way is something that I just continued through the rest of my childhood, into my teenage years, into my adult years, and at some point in my teenage years, I started writing my own music. And then in college is where I met Bear, and he was already scoring student films and stuff like that. And I had my band, and my band was playing all the time, and it was funny because we didn't know each other at all for a while, but all of our friends knew each other. And I remember there was one night I was cramming for a music history final with my friend Megan, and she had to call this guy because he needed her to sing in a choir for something he was scoring. And so she was on the phone with this Bear person getting details, and I'm like, who is this asshole who is taking time away from my study session with my friend? And several times I wanted to hire musicians for something I was doing, but they couldn't go. Cause why? They were doing something for Bear. And I'm like, who is this? And I think he was having the same experience too on his side, where it's like, who is this person who has the musicians I need for right now? And then, you know, after a while, I think he finally came to a show and then we became friends and then he started hiring me. That's actually how I've never told publicly the story of how we met, but, he hired me. I would like to say it's more romantic than that, but I mean, I guess it sort of was because we both, you know, recognized like, we both, respected each other's talents, you know, and kind of shared this world where, you know, it was sort of inevitable that we would meet each other eventually because everyone else we knew each other. That wasn't directly the answer to your question, though.
No, that was actually a very, very fleshed out answer to a question.
Oh, okay.
It was about, because actually I had more bullet points under the bold word background. And I started with youth and childhood music environment and you just took us straight up to marriage. So that's great.
Yeah. Well, we didn't actually get married then. It took an extraordinarily long time till we got married. But that was when we met each other, you know, predating Battlestar and all that. I don't know how many people are familiar with that part. I don't know if Outlander people are Battlestar crossover people as well.
You know, you'd be surprised. I know my dad was, and I was very young when the original Battlestar came out. And so when the reboot came out, just the name alone, it had obviously the name significance. And so that alone was what got my dad to watch it. And of course, then I had to, I mean, my dad is, he's the one who got me into Buffy.
Okay. Yeah.
When my dad mentions Buffy and I watched one or two episodes and I said, before I watched it, I was like, oh my God, that name, I cannot watch a show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I'm embarrassed that my dad likes it. So, but I started watching it and I was hooked. So I thought, okay, I got to trust him because Battlestar was amazing.
Yeah. You know, my dad is responsible for getting me into a lot of stuff that my friends at the time did not understand. Like he early on he got me into Star Wars and various science fiction kinds of things. But it's funny because actually, musically he got me into, you know, kind of people that would seem obscure like Frank Zappa or Steely Dan, but he also got me into the Beatles. And, you know, stuff that I was digging and I would show up with a Frank Zappa CD to a high school party and everyone would just give me dirty looks because it's not really whatever, you know, it wasn't, I don't know what was going at the time. I don't even know. I took a huge vacation from pop music like during my teen years when I was supposed to be in it. But it's funny because I think there's actually some like Scotch-Irish connection through the Yarbrough, which is my, you know, name side of the family. And so it's funny, and which is funny because the Yarbrough side of my family are the black people. So it's like, oh, that's the connection through there. And then I end up marrying a McCreary. So it's like, it all kind of comes around. But my dad would sing like all these Scottish songs. I don't remember a bunch of them now. I don't know why he knew these things. Because he was a folk singer, like kind of an itinerant musician in the 1960s and kind of a wanderer, kind of a tumbling tumbleweed. And so he's just a crazy, crazy treasure trove of information. And so, there's kind of been some Scottish threads through my life coming from like odd directions all the way through. So all paths leading to Outlander, it kind of all makes sense. In a weird way.
It kind of, when you got to Outlander and you kind of, you know, maybe after you performed a little bit of it or had time to steep yourself in it and kind of look back and you realize that, you know what? You kind of laugh at, okay, I get you, fate.
we're
going for this.
I know. It is kind of funny. There was something else I wanted to say and I'm kind of forgetting what it was. Oh, I was just trying to think if I like left out anything with musical background.
I was curious. Do you play any instruments?
Yeah. I play guitar. I play piano.
Okay.
Yeah. I play those guys. And, I sing obviously. You know, when I perform, I pretty much just sing. I might pick up the guitar in a couple songs, but, you know, I really like to make a very strong connection with the audience. I like a lot of eye contact. I like to really speak to people. And I find that when I'm playing an instrument, I'm my attention is kind of 50% split, you know, and I kind of like to give all of the energy straight out to break that fourth wall. So I hire other people to play the instruments and it worked out well.
So turning now,
cat jumping on me right now. No, it's not your fault. It's the cat.
Oh.
It's, unless you're here somewhere. Yes. I have a 4-month-old kitten who is just jumping on me. Yes, you are. Oh my goodness.
Is it black by chance?
that are you ma'am? Are you a racist?
I'm just... No, the cat. No, because I think yes, bears shared pictures.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, we make so many politically incorrect jokes about the cats now.
Oh, God. But like, oh, no, she's never going to come back now. What did I do?
No, it's totally a joke. No, because they're both, we adopted them. And the reason we adopted these two was because they were the tiniest cats at the place. They were so tiny. And so I brought my daughter and we just had to pick the teeniest kitties we could find. And so we got these teeny little kitties and they were 2 months old. Now they're 4 months old. And it just happens that they're house panthers, basically. They're both completely pitch black. And I like to make fun of Bear because it's like when you're in a multiracial marriage, there's like no holds barred. It's like everything is on the table for comedy. And so, you know, when he's like, when he calls one by the wrong name, I'm like, you can't tell them apart. Dude, you're racist. You are racist, dude. Anyway. Yeah. No, it's all good.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So let us now with the background of the house panthers. Yeah. And actually my Torties panthers are in the bedroom since I didn't want them knocking down the wall, coming to try and sit on my lap when I record, whatever. So let's turn now to North of Sunset, West of Vine.
Sure.
So what in general, so with I guess any of your albums, not necessarily only this one, what is your process, if you have one, for creating this new album? Do you go theme first and then find things that work, or do you start composing and then notice a theme beginning to develop?
Well, because the origins of this piece was a collection of writings. I decided at some point after moving away from Hollywood Boulevard, right? What happened, I'm trying to condense like so much history right here, is that my dad's apartment burned down, right? And so after that, he moved elsewhere. And I didn't go back to Hollywood Boulevard for a decade because there was, while it was a fascinating experience living there, it was, you know, it was a traumatic time in my life. You know, it was like, you know, recognizing the split up of my family. And my dad was super poor, so that was very hard. And a lot of the people we met, I mean, I think some of them were alcoholics and people who were dealing with, you know, very grown up problems that were a lot for me to handle, you know, at that time. And oh, hi, honey. Mommy's doing an interview. Yeah.
I just want to talk.
Oh, you want to hug me? Okay, thank you. I love you. I love you, Boo Boo. I'll see you in a second. Sorry, so much life is going on right now
while I'm doing this podcast.
she's a sweetheart. She's four, but she's been telling everyone that she's six. She decided that today that she's six. And I was like, you didn't invite me to two of your birthday parties then. And I'm pretty upset about that. Anyway, getting back to my oh so dramatic life. Anyway, long story short, I had to, I couldn't face going back to Hollywood Boulevard for a long time because there was a lot of difficult memories, you know, there. But then finally I was pulled back there actually to go to a party with Bear. And I ended up standing on this rooftop kind of across the street from the El Capitan. And it just looked different to me. I'd gotten enough distance that I could look back at the memories and instead of being painful, they were colorful. And that made me want to write about them. So I started writing stories, which were kind of character profiles of people I met. This woman named Dolly, there's a song called Dolly on the album. Dolly was a regular at a club called Thai Ice Cuisine. She was very, very interesting, very unique. And there's a guy named, he wasn't named. I don't know what his name was. I called him the captain because he wore like this captain hat all the time, but he was, you know, I had a scary encounter with him, which was, you know, I was probably 8 or 9. And, you know, he got a lot closer to me than he should have. And I was wondering if I should have defended myself and things like that. And there's a song on the record about that. It's called On the Rocks. And so all of these stories, they turned into a one woman show kind of thing that I did at a bunch of different clubs around LA. Then I expanded it into a multi-person show. I remember coming home from one show and talking to Bear and being like, I think this show wants more people. I think it wants more than me. So I fleshed it out to a cast of about 6 and we performed at the Greenway Theater in, I think it was 2013 or something like that. And we did a run. It got up to the point of being a staged reading with just an incredible cast of just beautiful people. One of the people in the cast actually was Michael Hogan, who played Colonel Ty on Battlestar Galactica, if anyone cares about that. Then directly after that performance, I was moving towards fleshing it out even more. Then I became filled with a human and had a baby. And that takes some time, I figured out. No one told me how much. Actually, that's not true. Everyone told me how much time it was going to take. But you just don't believe it till you go through it. So I kind of had to step away for a second and like make a person and like figure out what that was all about once she popped into the world. During that time, I sang the Skyboat song. I recorded it during my 8th month. Very much not standing up because I had no energy for that. But so I sat on a chair in the studio and sang that song. And she knows that, actually. My daughter knows that. And she refers to that song as our duet. It's very cute.
Aw, that's adorable.
This is all a roundabout way of saying after about a year of taking care of small human, I recognized what I wanted to do with the album. And it didn't want to be a stage show. It didn't want to be a bunch of stories. It wanted to be a concept album. So I extracted just the music from the stage play and retooled some of the songs a little bit so that they could stand on their own, and then just recorded it. And it took a few years to get it right, to get what I wanted to be the feeling of my time there. We did some soundscape elements, like sounds of, shoes walking, sounds of a restaurant or a bar, sounds of hand clapping, just all kinds of different things to kind of put you in an element and a place, and not just a musical sonic space. Because I still wanted it to feel like a group of stories, even though now it was a purely musical experience. So to encapsulate all of that, the words came first. And the music came to the words after that. That's how this particular record came together.
Well, that not just obviously, hopefully musicians, writers, composers, they want their music, their lyrics, obviously to tell a story, whether it comes about in the way that your album did or not, however it comes about, their whole effort is to share a story, tell a story. But yours, in your very unique way that this all came together, was incredibly effective. Incredibly effective. Aww. I am not a jazz aficionado at all. No, I'm not a jazz expert. I have sung, full disclosure, I have a bachelor's of music. Nice. My first degree is in classical vocal performance. So I also went to music school. And so, but that's, jazz is not really, really, especially technically, in my wheelhouse. And jazz harmonies can be notoriously challenging, especially for vocalists. Oh my goodness. I did a tiny bit. I kind of moonlighted in vocal jazz ensembles throughout high school and college.
Yeah.
I was usually that top squeaking soprano, like in Birdland or Caravan.
Yeah.
It was so much fun. Exactly.
It happened in Birdland.
Exactly. And it was so much fun, but it was also so scary, and don't even get me started on scatting, right?
Oh, yeah. That's a great thing. Scatting is a great thing.
But it's also exhilarating because it's so bare and there's nowhere to hide. And all this to say, this album showcases your precision of pitch, your mastery of rhythm, and your settling into sounds, into words and phrasing. And I thought, I don't have a jazzy background, but oh my goodness, could I hear your story? And so what is it, besides obviously your early influence, because your dad's a big part of that and his being a musician. Besides that influence, which we understand now, what is it about jazz music that attracts you over and over and keeps you coming back?
It is the harmonies. It's that the harmonies are deep and dark and lush, and they don't always go where you think they're going to go. There are certain, formulaic jazz, like idiomatic standbys, like, 2-5-1, it's like, and that's how you get back to the tonic. But you don't have to do that. you don't have to go back to the tonic. You don't have to stay in your key. You don't have to, basically it's with jazz, it's like there is an awareness of the rules of Western music, but you have that awareness so that you can break the rules, so that you can do things that are unexpected. Then again, you can always go to free jazz land where it's literally free and there's no tonal center of any sort anywhere and you don't want one. But I like jazz because the expression comes first, you know? Mm. It's like the rules are there to help with the expression, but if the expression explodes outward from the rules, that's fine. You know, the walls are there to be broken down, and that's what I like about it. I like that the melodies are interesting. I like that it's challenging because there's something about a challenging and ranging melody that seems to naturally evoke emotion within you as you're performing it. And then when there's words laid over that are meaningful to you, then you kind of can't help but give over to the experience, you know? And when the performer is having that experience and when you're really, really in the middle of what you feel, you take people, you know, you take people with you. The audience can't help but kind of be there, you know? So that's what it is. I think jazz is just overtly expressive, you know? And in its, I feel like in its best expression, it's a little bit uncomfortable. You know, because being raw and being honest is uncomfortable. It's ultimately, you know, clarifying and purifying of your being, you know, of your, what's the word I'm looking for? It's, it brings you to epiphanies, you know, through the challenge of it. Yeah. That's where I was going.
Very briefly before we slide into Outlander, before we, wrap up, my favorite, and it was surprising to me. I don't know why, but my favorite track was track 9, Race Car 49.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And as I was listening, and I hadn't looked up who wrote what, where it came from. I didn't look up the provenance of anything. I just listened first. And as I was listening, I was like, you know, this sounds like it's not maybe a traditional Christmas song, but it sounds like a song around kind of a Christmassy theme, right?
Yeah.
And then I made a connection because my favorite Christmas album is the Vince Guaraldi Trio's Charlie Brown Christmas. It's jazzy and it's also a little maudlin. You know, it's not all happy.
No, it's not.
And so I thought, wow. So, and then I started going to look for this and I found your lovely blog post that talks about what Race Car 49 actually was and what it meant to you. You wrote in 2010, quote, Race Car 49 particularly embodies the vibration, the narrative that will extend into my next full album. So you've already talked about how the album came to be. Do you believe that this vibration, this type of narrative was actually finally fulfilled in your album?
Yes, I do feel like, my idea is that that each song would be its own world, its own little narrative destiny. In and of itself. And I think the songs are that. I think they come from one world together, but they each tell their own story. So in that way, I think I got there. it's funny because I got to do a bunch of string writing on this record, which makes me very, very happy because it's something I've always loved doing. And finally, I just got the chance. I was able to work with the Calder Quartet, who works on Outlander all the time. And you know, it's like it takes a long time to do a string arrangement. I mean, it doesn't take Bear that much time. It takes me longer because, I mean, just because I have the luxury of time and, you know, and so, you know, giving it to them to play, like, boy, oh boy, did they make me sound like I knew what I was doing. So that song, is special to me because I got to do things musically that I have been wanting to do for a long time. And my next project actually is a string quintet that I'm writing for now. And so it's the next record is definitely going to be in that direction with a whole lot more stringiness going on because I love the way string music sounds. It's naturally kind of cinematic, but it's also I feel like it's reflective in a really unique way. I feel like strings are really close to voices. And so they're evocative, and they can be very challenging. They can sound nasty and mean, or they can sound just, you know, gorgeous and, you know, like a feather in the air, you know? So yeah, I actually think Race Car 49, does a good job of representing like the past, like the stories I already told on that record. And I think it also represents where I'm going. So it's interesting that you would pick that one, that you would like that one. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, I very much appreciate it.
Yeah.
So soaring ever so slightly into Outlander.
Yeah.
So in case someone has not listened to our show before, or heaven forbid, hasn't heard you or of your name, Rhea is our artist, our vocalist, who gives us, who transforms the opening credits, basically. She is the voice behind the theme of the Skyboat song and many other things on throughout the show, throughout the soundtrack.
Yeah.
When you approach each, as we now know, you've had four, at least four, plus two chained or two different versions for season one. So, well, and then two for season two. So as you approach whatever change, whatever new version or new creation is for your next version of the Skyboat song, mm-hmm. how do you approach it? Since they're constantly changing, are you given some information as to the content, or do you are you able to see episodes before so you can kind of immerse yourself into this new world?
You know, Bear tells me. He tells me where the show he tells me where the show is going, and based on that, I try to feel it. A person is sitting on my lap now. Okay, you can sit here, but I have to talk to these people in my headphones. Okay, is that fine? Okay, I'm talking to them about the Skyboat song. You know that song. The Skyboat song that we both sang together when I was pregnant. Remember? Sing me a song. Honeybee.
We have a Christmas tree.
We have a Christmas tree now? That's wonderful. Okay. Okay. Anyway, if I get Sonatine to talk on here, you can leave it because that might be cute. So anyway, when it's time to record a new Outlander theme, basically I try to remember where we came from in the last season. And I try to think with an open heart, okay, what is Claire about to be up against, you know? And I usually know a little bit. I don't know plot ahead of time, which is true. I actually don't know plot ahead of time. But I have an idea. Sometimes Bear will give me an idea, like geographically, about what's happening. And he'll give me just a sense of what dangers might be coming her way, or just he gives me an emotional palette to play with, you know, so that I can put that into the performance. I like to feel like every time I sing it, I'm coming from her perspective, like I'm coming from her heart, you know. That's what I thought the very first time I sang it. I was like, this performance needs to embody where this woman has come from and where she's going. You know, it has to embody her conflicts. It has to embody her hopes and her fears. It has to embody, I see that, honey, thank you. It has to embody her, her passions, you know, and how dangerous her passions are, you know, and how deep her love is and how difficult that is, you know, if you find something in another world and it does not... and it is not compatible with your life should you go back to it, you know? So it's, you know, I mean, everyone knows that the book is all about, you know, getting lost, getting dangerously lost, getting fearfully lost in the greatest joy you could ever imagine, right? And so I wanted to put all of that into the original soundtrack. And in the original soundtrack, there was not a four-year-old playing with a thermometer. Please don't do that, honey. This one for the last season, for the season that's on currently, was just super fun because I don't ever get other voices to sing with, you know. And this time we got a few other twangy guys to sing harmonies with me, and it was just that was a riot. That was really fun. I felt like it was, I felt like it really opened up the theme energetically in ways that it hadn't been opened up before.
You actually jumped into the next question. What inspiration did you use for this beautiful bluegrass interpretation of the theme for this season four?
Thank you. First of all, I think it's so fun. You know, honestly, the arrangement inspired me. I mean, you know, everything that that Bear did to augment the theme was pretty much all the emotional information I needed, you know, to go for it. So a lot of it is in Bear's arrangement, you know, because, you know, he has that there, you know, as a world for me to step into every time I come in and sing the theme.
Beautiful. It's just beautiful. I have one more question because it's something that I find so fascinating. So one of the most effective, I'm a book reader fan for almost mm-hmm. 20 years. I'm a Bear fan. Okay. I'm a You fan. I'm an everything fan, but I am one of those probably annoying people. And I know it's annoying because my sister tells me, she's my co-host. We'll be talking about the latest episode and I will say, and right here, right up here at minute 1203, when Bree walks on the blah, 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 or when Claire picks up the hay, whatever it is, that's the love theme. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
When she walks over here, that's the druid theme. And then this happens and it gets slower. And then this theme comes. And people look at me like I am crazy town. And like, it's just an ear. There are so many that Bear does that you do with different arrangements of themes. One of the most beautiful and effective is when he takes different themes and layers them together, whether it's the time travel theme with the love theme, or although we hasn't been confirmed yet because we're still waiting on his first Outlander post, what sounds like over and over and over the Bree and Roger theme. We hear some of the dancing druid theme coming up with, which features you, coming up with this Bree and Roger theme. And when he puts these themes together, it's mind-blowing that, because they're separately, they're beautiful, but together it is awe-inspiring. It's just so gorgeous. And so my question for you is, how do you feel? So wait, when you have the Skyboat song, you have lyrics, right? You have words, you have a sense of what Bear wants you to bring. When you're doing something like the Dance of the Druid theme or some other type of cue.
I love that one.
How do you bring, my guess is he probably gives you a feeling or a hint again, but how do you, when you don't have, in the absence of words, in the absence of context, how do you bring so much life and beauty to these other cues?
You know, I mean, like I said, I try to put myself in the moment, you know, I try to think of what it would be like if I were one of the dancing women in the stones. What do those women know? You know, what do they know? Where do they come from to do this? Are they bringing all of the light and the darkness of their lives with them when they dance and do this ritual? Are they shaking their lives off and becoming truly liberated when they do this ritual? You know, it's probably both, depending on who the women are. It's almost like I feel like I'm kind of an ephemeral consciousness, like skipping from woman to woman to woman. I'm just talking about the Dance of the Druids one. You know, dancing from woman to woman to woman, trying to discover the whole of their existence. You know, I mean, coming to that place and performing that ritual, like, you have to have some serious reasons for doing that, you know, and it's not to be taken lightly, you know, and also everything, although these are fictional novels, they are based in, you know, actual legend, actual lore, and actual rituals and things that people do and believe. So there's more weight and more history to every story, to every image, to every note of this series than just what we're presented with at that moment, you know? So I'm trying to swirl history with fantasy with those things. And I mean, frankly, that kind of an interpretation is beyond words, you know? So just being able to release that feeling and mix that in with the music is the goal.
Well, then I'll just follow up and ask, since I believe you're right, that it is beyond words and it's beyond music, quite frankly, sometimes.
Yeah.
Is that process, especially Dance of the Druids, that there's something about that piece. Has it, performing especially a wordless piece, is it cathartic ever for yourself?
Yeah, it is. it definitely is. And it's an honor to give a voice to moments like that. You know, I mean, it's an honor to feel that I can be a character in this great story, in this series, you know, in the way that it, you know, in whatever way I am. yeah, it's like I feel that place. I feel that artistic space about it.
Well, thank you so much, Rhea, for joining us and spending your very, very valuable time, especially with all the little ones, the house panthers and the little one crawling around.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about any upcoming projects that you are at liberty to mention?
Let me see. Are you just repeating me now?
Yeah.
Okay. She's just repeating everything I say now. Okay. upcoming projects would be, like I said, actually I have some deep future performances if you'd like to know about that. In April and March, I will be performing at a place called The Baked Potato, which is in the Valley. And I will be there with my string ensemble, for which I have to write a lot more music, but I'm not going to think about that right now, or mommy will need a glass of wine. let me find those dates actually, and I can actually tell you when they are. I usually stick a little Outlander in my live performances when I can. So the two dates are March 14th and April 18th, where I will be at the Baked Potato in North Hollywood, I think it is. And that should be fun. It's going to be with a different group than I have been with before. It's going to be with my string ensemble. A night of strings and potatoes.
Hey, I think that sounds great. Well, thank you so much for letting us know. And we'll put your mentioning, obviously, all about the album, all of the materials that that Kaylin was provided us with your bio, your headshot, all of that stuff will go into the accompanying blog post as well.
Oh, great. Oh, and there's two music videos that I have now. So I hope those come. Sonatine, do you want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay, what do you want to say?
I know that you're good.
What'd you say?
I know that you're good.
You know that I'm good? Mm-hmm. Well, that's awfully nice. Thank you.
Mommy, like, loving tasty.
Honey, do you want to sing some of the Skyboat song with me?
No.
Are you sure?
Sing it by yourself.
Really? Do you want to? Because I know you know it. Are you sure?
No,
you don't want to sing a little bit?
I want to sing.
Huh?
I want to sing Man in Shadow.
You want to sing? Oh, you want to sing Man in Shadow? Oh, she wants to sing a different song from my record, but maybe that'll be from another time.
Sure.
She was singing On the Rocks, On the Rocks, On the Rocks, which is one of my songs. That's so funny. Good job, girl. Good job, baby.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Have a great night. Have a great weekend. Bye, Sonatine.
Okay, she says bye.
Bye.
Say
bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay. Bye. Bye. Bye, Rhea. Bye. Bye. Thank you, Sabrina.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you again to Rhea and everyone at Defiant PR who made this interview possible. We loved learning about Rhea's background, her musical background, her training, and of course it was nice to hear a little bit about Bear, but that was not why we had her on. We're always interested in finding out more about the people who are in any way tangentially connected or first degree connected to Outlander, and learning more about Rhea's background and her interest and talent in and for jazz, and being able to listen to her latest album, definitely was an education about Rhea. And if you guys have not checked that out, definitely check out her album, North of Sunset, West of Vine. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.